does give me great pleasure to introduce Professor Nigel Crook. Nigel is Professor of AI and Robotics, Associate Dean for Research and Knowledge Exchange, and Director of the Centre for AI, Culture and Society at Oxford Brookes University. That seems quite a lot of work, so we're especially grateful you found time to come here. Nigel graduated from Lancaster University with a BSc in Computing and Philosophy in 1982. He has a PhD in Explainable Intelligent Machines and nearly 40 years of experience as a researcher in AI and lecturing in computer science. He's author of The Rise of the Moral Machine, Exploring Virtue Through a Robot's Eyes. That's the book that's going to be available. He's an expert reviewer for the European Commission and serves on several scientific committees for international conferences. And his research interests include biologically inspired machine learning, spatial robotics, and autonomous moral machines. So well qualified for today's talk, Consciousness, Creativity, and Generative AI. Over to you, Nigel.
Well, thank you, Andrew, and thank you for inviting me here. It's a real pleasure to be with you this evening. I hope that what I'm going to say is going to be at least informative and even more helpful. I picked this title, Consciousness, Creativity, and Generative AI, because I feel at the moment there's a tension going on with the technology that's coming out that appears to be very human-like in the outputs that it generates, which is then leading many people to think about what it is to be human, what it is to be conscious, what it is to be a creative person. And so I'm going to try and tackle this, and they all will connect together, as you hopefully will see, and I'm going to approach them in reverse order. So I'll start with generative AI, say something about creativity, and then delve into the depths of consciousness without the aid of a safety belt. So I did ask ChatGPT to pen something for us this evening. I put in my abstract for the talk, and I asked it to write a poem about this, and this is only three, I think there were six verses altogether. I didn't give it a limitation, and it came up with something like this. I'll just read out a few lines. For in the heart of consciousness, where soul and spirit blend, lies the essence of creation where humanity ascends, a sacred flame that bursts within, igniting every thought, a gift bestowed on humankind, a treasure to be sought. Looks like it was generated by someone who was not only conscious, but also quite creative with words, wouldn't you say? Yeah? So a little test for you now, audience participation, if I may. I want you to tell me which of these pictures you think are generated by AI. Who thinks A? Okay, who thinks B? More people think B. Okay, that's interesting. Who thinks C? Not so sure. And D? Some for D, okay. What about this one? E? Yeah. And F? Not 100% convinced. G? And H? Well, if you put your hand up at all, you were right, because all of them were generated. They all were, which is just remarkable. Remarkable that technology can create images like this that look so realistic to us. Sometimes if you look at enough of these, you can begin to see some features that that occur very often. It gets hands wrong a lot, so you can see on this one, on H, that the hands are wrong. Sometimes there's an extra hand or an extra leg. And it not just words and image and photographs, but also artwork. These are all AI-generated pieces of art. Don't know whether you like them or not. I'm not sure if I like them, really. But they look art-like, don't they? And also music. I was going to put some music on there, but I decided it was a bit too technical, really, for me. No, it wasn't really, but I just had enough in there already. But you can generate music of any style you like with any singer, all fabricated, all generated on the fly with the technology. How does it do it? So the next few minutes, what we're going to do is just lift the lid up on a couple of the technologies that are involved in generating these kind of outputs so that you have a handle on where it's coming from, and you can begin to get a hold of this issue of what is creativity in this context. So the first approach I'm going to share with you is called generative adversarial networks. And I'm going to use an analogy to help you understand what the algorithm actually does underneath it all. So imagine there's a bank that hires two new members of staff. There's one person who works as a clerk, and the job of the clerk in this bank is just to detect forged banknotes, right, and to separate them out. The other person is hired and works in the back office, but unbeknown to the bank is a budding forger, right? So this person is trying to forge banknotes. Now, to begin with, they're both new at their jobs. They don't really know what they're doing. And what happens is the clerk is given a stack of banknotes to look at and thinks that they're all real. They're coming from a pile of real banknotes at the top there. But now the forger tries to slip some in. But the forger is so bad at forging banknotes that it's quite clear to the clerk, even though she's very new in the job, that these are just not real banknotes, right? They're fairly obvious. The thing is that she's learning how to detect the difference between real and fake banknotes and getting better at it. But unbeknown to her, the forger is watching what she's doing and is saying, oh, that's how she's detecting the difference. Okay, I'll deal with that, and starts to produce better forged banknotes so that in the end, the forger produces banknotes that could fool even the very best expert. That's it. That's how generative adversarial, you can see because they're competing against each other, networks work. So how does that work? What's going on a bit deeper down underneath all that? In fact, underneath all of the algorithms that we are familiar with today that generate content for us is something called artificial neural networks. Hands up if you've heard of artificial neural networks. Oh, quite a few people. That's really good. So artificial neural networks are inspired by how the brain works with brain cells. They're very, very simplified, highly simplified simulations of neurons, if you like. And the circles at the bottom part of the picture are meant to be these artificial neurons. And think of them like light switches, on, off. So they could be binary, on or off, outputting a one or a zero. Or they could be like a dimmer switch, bright or dark. And what happens is that you get other neurons that have values on them. You can see on the left, the bottom, one, zero. These are passed along connections that have numbers on them, 0.5 on one of them and minus 0.3 on the other. These are like the connections in the brain, the synapses that have a strength. And once you've taken that input, what you do is if you can multiply and add, hands up who can't multiply and add, nobody. You can all do this then. You can all do this. So it's 1 times 0.5 plus 0 times minus 0.3, which is 0.5. That gets pushed into the neuron at the top where it says output layer. If that value is above a threshold above a particular value, then this output neuron puts its hand up, says 1. If it doesn't, it just says 0. And on the other side, it's a dial, so it kind of goes up a bit if it's a small input, or it goes up a lot. That's basically it. What happens when it learns is that these numbers, that 0.5 and minus 0.3, are adjusted so that when you get a certain input, you get the output that you want, right? So this is as technical as I'm going to get, okay? So if you get that, you get enough of what's going on under the hood. And if we just go back to generative adversarial networks, that's a kind of a diagram of one. So on the right, you can see a discriminator. That's the clerk trying to detect true or false images that are coming in. The images are coming from two sources. There's a bank of real images, real photographs, and then there's the ones that the forger, which we call the generator, creates, and it creates them from a random input. And the generator is observing when the discriminator gets it right or wrong and is adjusting its own connections so that it produces better quality images. And over time, it gets extremely good. There we go. So that's that. That's your first algorithm we've looked at. But what I want to do now is to dig into... This is obviously for the creation of images or anything that's pictorial representation, but I want to also dig into the language generation stuff that we see a lot of. ChatGPT, hands up if you've heard of ChatGPT. A lot of people have. It's had a huge impact. And I want to give you a little bit of the backstory to how we arrived at ChatGPT. So going back quite some way, there's a lot of work had been done on how you figure out what a piece of text is actually about, what the subject matter of the text is. You could have articles that are on sport or on music or on science, and how do you distinguish between them? And there was a linguist called John Rupert Firth who said, famously in linguistic circles, "You shall know a word by the company it keeps." What does he mean by that? Well, let me give you an example. If I said, "I went to the bank and fed the ducks," okay? And later on I said, "I went to the bank and cashed a check." Does everybody here know what cashing a check is? Because we don't do that anymore. So you can see straight away the context, the words around the word bank tell you what the meaning is, okay? And that's what a lot of this technology uses. It's the company that words keep. And what the original technique was to, let's just ignore the structure of a document, the sentences and that. Let's just treat a document as a bag of words and count the number of times each word occurs. And let's see, that should give us a feel, that mix of counts should give us a feel for what this document is about. It's like pulling tiles out of a bag. You just keep pulling them out and say, oh, there's a lot of words around sport here, you know. So this looks like a sporting document. But what you can do with that is you can then take a document, and each of the dots in that three-dimensional space there is a document that has a number of words in it. I can only project three dimensions in two dimensions, hope you appreciate that, which means that we have a vocabulary of three words, but it's just for illustration purposes. But each dot is counting the number of times those three words occur in the document, and that's why you get a different arrangement within that space. And then when you have that, what you can do is you can see that there are certain groups or clusters of documents that are kind of in the same area. And it turns out that those are generally related within the same area, generally related to the same kind of topic. So that if you get a new document coming in, you just count the number of words, your three words in your vocabulary, and then you plot it in this graph. And you see, well, which cluster is it in? oh, it's in the science cluster. This is likely to be a science paper. So that's kind of how that would work. Now, significant thing happened in 2013 with the publication of papers relating to word vectors, or word to vec, as it was called then, had caused a bit of a stir, actually. And essentially what they did was that they took one of those networks that I showed you with those neurons, and they trained it on some words together, sentences and things like that, and then they used the connections to come up with a list of numbers, which is called a vector in mathematical terms. And I've given you an example here in just two dimensions, x and y, and each word you'll see has in brackets two numbers after it. That's a vector. It's just an ordered list of numbers. All right? And you'll see that words that have kind of related associations, like cow and pig and farm, are close together. And words that are quite different, like love and car, or tractor and hate, are far apart. And this turned out to be quite powerful. And this is what is referred to as word embeddings, because there's something in those two little numbers there. It's actually in the real thing, it's hundreds of numbers, but we need to worry about that. In those two little numbers there, that capture something of the meaning of each of those words in relation to other words, and that's very important. So then, in kind of alongside this, going back way back to the 1980s, researchers in a field called computational linguistics were trying to develop systems that could estimate the probability of a sequence of words. And they were called language models. Essentially, what it was is it's just looking at to see if that sequence of words is a sequence that it probably would have found in its data set that it was trained on. So how likely is it that that sequence of words would come out? Which essentially means that that sequence of words is meaningful, because those models were trained on meaningful data sets, like, you know, whole books, electronic books and things like that, where people had written words and it had learnt the ordering of the words, and it can figure out how likely it is. Now, and the example that I've given you, that you there, the sequence of words, "the moon is made of cheese," would give you a high probability from a decent language model, because it makes sense, right? We understand what it means. We know it's not true, right? So the probability isn't the probability that it's true, it's the probability that it's meaningful. Right. If we switch the order of the words, cheese of the is moon made, that would get a low probability. Any programmers here? Or people done programming? Okay, yes. So the same techniques can be used in programming and are being used. You can ask ChatGPT to generate Python code. One of the first things we did with ChatGPT was give it one of our second year computer science assignments, and it did a reasonable fist of generating a program in Python from a specification. It's a little bit worrying for teaching computer science, but never mind, we'll not get into that. So it's exactly the same issue. It's a sequence of tokens. Words are just tokens. Yeah. So the next thing to hit the scene was in 2017, when Google published a paper entitled "Attention is All You Need." Now, when people working in this area were trying to develop these language models that had calculated the probability of sequences of words, they were using lots of sort of convoluted architectures with loops going back, because one of the key things is working out what is the relationship between the word I'm looking at now and all the other words in the text. And that's what's called attention. And the previous methods had quite complex loops and trying looping back to previous words, and it was not really working. But the transformer, which was published in that paper, broke all records. It was a very smart way of doing it. We won't go into details on how it did it, but essentially what it did was it managed to successfully learn on large pieces of text the long-term relationship between words. So I've given you an example here. It's actually a short story from my book. You can see it begins with Emily awoke drowsily. And then later on it says, she muttered, and as she lay there, then she remembered the cost. And the she's all refer back to Emily. That's a long-range relationship, right? And it's a hard problem to solve. It's a hard problem to solve. And the transformer developed by Google managed to do it. And just to give you an idea, so GPT 3.5, if you're into this kind of thing, has an attention span of 4,000 tokens. So that's 4,000 words. It can figure out what the long-range relationship is within 4,000 words. That's about 3 pages of text. GPT-4 improved that to 32,000 tokens. 32,000 tokens, words that are 32,000 words apart, it can figure out what the probability is of the relationship between them occurring in those positions. So very, very clever technology. There's a picture of it there, which we won't go through in detail, but you can see at the bottom, there's input embeddings. So those vectors, those embeddings that I told you about, are core to this, are put in. And what you get is input going in, you get your expected output, those two come together, and you get a set of probabilities of what the sequence of words is that you've provided. So, how did we get from that, these transformers, to ChatGPT? GPT was developed by OpenAI, and essentially what they did was they took the transformer and they used it to try and predict what the next word would be in a sequence. So we have here, once upon a. What would be the most, what would you say was the time? We all know that one. Once upon a time is the most likely, we all know this, so we're all transformers in disguise, no pun intended. So we can do it, and the algorithm can do it. And what they did was they kind of used the transformer to figure out the probability of every word in their dictionary being the next word in that sequence. And you can see I put these little sort of peaks in to indicate where the probabilities are. Then what the algorithm does is it rolls a dice that is weighted. It effectively rolls a dice, and not really rolling a dice inside, just it effectively rolls a dice that is weighted according to those probabilities. And so the word that comes out is likely to be a highly probable next word, but it might not be once upon a time. If it could think of something else that's reasonably probable, it might pick that. This is called sampling in statistical context. So the GPT, the generative pre-trained transformer, so it's pre-trained on all the content of the internet plus more, the generative bit is using this kind of dice rolling, weighted dice rolling mechanism. Now let's just have a quick look at how it does it. So if we have asked ChatGPT, for example, to create a story for us, and we give it the first word, which is once, that goes into the generative pre-trained transformer, and it rolls a dice, and out comes what it thinks is the next most probable words. Might not be the most probable word, but highly probable word, which is upon. Then it feeds that back in. All right, and then those words together go into the next round, yeah? Once upon a, and those three go, can you see? It's building up context, right? As it's generating this, the next word has to be relevant to the previous words it's generated, and that's how it does it. And it keeps doing that until it comes across a place where the next most probable thing is a full stop. Or the end of a paragraph, and then it stops. That's how it does it. Okay, so now you understand enough about ChatGPT to know that it's not trying to communicate with you. Right? It is not trying to communicate with you. It is not empathetic. It is just generating highly probable sequences of words, and it's doing it extremely well, which makes you think that it's a conscious agent that's doing it, but it's not. It's an algorithm, okay? Highly predictable algorithm. So that then brings me on to thinking a little bit about creativity. I'm strongly influenced by a guy called Dallas Willard. I don't know if you've heard of him. He was a professor of philosophy at the University of Southern California, passed away a few years ago. Very influential in certain areas, very big on discipleship. And one of the things that he talked a lot about were the essential dimensions of the human self, which he brilliantly, in my view, links to how people develop virtue and all that kind of stuff. And so I'm going to refer to this because I think I find it helpful, and I hope you do too. And the way he describes it, he comes up with five essential dimensions. He calls them dimensions, which is absolutely brilliant to call them dimensions, because it kind of captures the fact that they're all kind of part of the same thing, but yet distinct. And he always depicts them as concentric circles. So in the middle, heart, will, and spirit basically describe the same dimension, just different aspects of it. Heart is its position within the human person, central. Will is its function, your ability to choose. And spirit describes its nature, non-physical. All right. And then within that, outside of that, the next circle is thought and feeling. And that whole circle that contains that is considered to be the mind. That's what Dallas would say is the mind, is heart, will, spirit, thought, and feelings is the mind. Then you have the body, and then the social context. We're in a social context now. We're interacting. Well, I'm interacting with you. This is the way it is. So we're in a social context. We're getting signals from that. We're processing those. And then, interestingly, he puts the soul around the outside. And the reason that he does that is because, in his view, the soul is what coordinates everything. I haven't got time, unfortunately, to unpack that for you. But if you haven't come across it, Renovating the Human Heart is a superb book. I would highly recommend it to you, where he describes this in detail. But from... Yes, it's hidden, isn't it? It's Dallas Willard. Willard, yeah. A-R-D at the end. Yeah. Really recommend, highly recommend reading him. So for me, the creativity is a combined expression of all those dimensions. By the way, do you know where he got this from? Anybody know? Yes? I don't know that. Oh, really? Okay. That wasn't what I was thinking of. I was thinking much older. When was that person around? Okay. I'm thinking sort of New Testament, Old Testament time. Shema. Anybody know what the Shema is? Yeah? Yeah, Shema is. And the key bit is, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Okay, so that's where it comes from. That's his thinking, pulling that together. Those are the essential dimensions of the human self. And to me, they're all involved in the creative act. Creativity itself, the way I understand it, is that it is fed by our experience. And it's enriched by the development of skill. Think of a virtuoso violinist playing. You know, why do we go and sit and listen to someone scratching out a tune on a violin? And why can it fill a whole auditorium? It's because they've poured themselves into that skill. Their soul, their very soul. And when they're playing, it's an expression of their soul and all that experience they've had, all the practice they put into it and developing that skill. So it's a combination. And I've put it coming from the soul there, but actually it comes from not just the soul, but the social context and the body and the mind as well. All of that comes together in the creative act. But in particular, the thing that we're interested in this evening is the fact that creativity is not just random. We're not just rolling a dice, although maybe some artists do that. I don't know. I'm not an artist. But in general, that's not the approach that we take to generating creative pieces of work. It involves purposeful activity that's directed by conscious, intentional action. We choose to do something, right? So consciousness and free will are essential, in my view, to creativity. And I want to just tackle consciousness because that is also, under attack. Our traditional understanding and our theological understanding of consciousness has been challenged by developments in neuroscience recently. There's quite a lot of voices out there that are challenging our understanding of what consciousness is, and I just want to say a few things about that from my perspective. Bearing in mind, I'm not actually a philosopher. I did half a degree 4 decades ago, so that doesn't make me a philosopher. And there are smarter people than me thinking about this, but this is my take on it. So consciousness is a phenomena that almost everybody who has ever been born has experienced, but almost nobody can define. Not even the experts and the philosophers agree on what consciousness actually is, right? Which makes things very challenging when you're trying to get a handle on it. And there are very, very different views, and it's impossible for me to even give you a hint of the breadth of different perspectives there are on this subject. But I'm just going to give you some highlights so that you've got a handle on it. And generally, it's understood that there are two different types of consciousness. There's access consciousness, referred often to as A consciousness, where there's a representation of something. So, for example, you might see an apple, and in your conscious mind, there's a representation of it, right? And the reason that's important is that you can do things with that representation. So you can, for example, think, gosh, I would like to eat that apple. I'm rather hungry. So that representation that's in your mind allows you to think thoughts about it, to reason about it explicitly, and that's called access consciousness. And the other kind of consciousness is called phenomenal consciousness, P consciousness, which is much more to do with the experience you have, the conscious experience you have of what you're perceiving. So that's my attempt to animate conscious experience. It's something that kind of goes on inside us when we see something, when we experience something through our senses. We experience it in a first-person manner. So, for example, you might experience the taste of the apple. You might experience the redness of a rose. Okay, and that is a first-person experiential thing. It's very subjective. There's a word that's been devised in philosophy to describe it, and it's called qualia. I know some people are nodding their heads. Qualia, which is means something it is like to be, which I don't find terribly helpful. But essentially, it's describing that subjective experience that we have in consciousness. And it's the qualia that actually is the most challenging bit, according to philosophers, of consciousness. Thomas Nagel, as a philosopher, famously posed the question, what is it like to be a bat? We see a bat. What's a bat's experience of life? Can we get a handle on that? What he basically said was, he was arguing that it's impossible to answer that question. Because it asks about this subjective experience, this first-person experience, which is not accessible. We're not the bat. Only the bat can experience what it's like to be a bat. And he says we can analyze the sensory system of the bat and the way the neurons convey information from the ears and the eyes to the brain. We can analyze all that. We could understand all that. But we can never actually know what it's like to experience those signals that that particular bat experiences. And of course, it extends to humans as well. Now, another famous philosopher called David Chalmers has called this the hard problem of consciousness. And he says it's a hard problem because trying to explain subjective experience by reducing it to brain activity or brain processes, for example, will always be about the functioning of the brain and the behavior that it produces. It can never be about the subjective experience that the person who has those processes and who owns that brain have. So more recent work, very interesting in this area, is done by a number of neuroscientists who are leading in the consciousness studies research. And what they are working on the premise that it is the brain that gives rise to consciousness, right? The brain gives rise to consciousness in their view. And they're looking at ways of measuring consciousness in order to be able to demonstrate that it is the brain that's making it. And they can fiddle with people's sensory perceptions and they can see little bits of the brain light up and all those kind of things. And they're using that as a way of coming up with theories of consciousness arising from the brain. And they're doing one particular thing, which has got a lot of attention recently, which is they've come up with this measure called Phi. I don't know why they picked Phi. I have read his book, but I can't remember what he says about that. Anil Seth is one of the people that is leading on this. And Phi measures the amount, I'll get it from the notes because I'll get it exactly right. It's to do with the integration, how the brain is integrating information from various sensory sources. And it's that integration, that level of integration, that gives rise to consciousness. Oh, I have an animation there as well. Look at that. Okay. Covered all that. But there are other neuroscientists that don't align with this view. There's one in particular that I know, Sharon Dirks. I don't know if you come across her. She's a Christian speaker, former neuroscientist, and she said this in a personal exchange email. She says, however sophisticated the descriptions of how physical processes correlate with conscious experience may be, that still doesn't account for how they are two very different things. Physical processes in the brain and consciousness are two very different things. Okay, let's unpack that a little bit. So I'm going to sort of tackle this from a few different angles. The first one is just to sort of highlight that, in my view, consciousness does not appear to be a property of matter, and brain is, of course, a material thing. It is matter. And whilst it's very clear that there is a deep connection between consciousness and the brain, we know that very well from experimental studies, and that interaction is a two-way thing, so the brain obviously can affect conscious states and conscious states can affect the brain. The thing to note about this is a entirely unique relationship in the whole of creation. It is only the brain. It's only brains that, as far as we know, are conscious. No physical matter other than the brain appears to have this privileged association with consciousness. And what's more, consciousness appears not to be a property that's owned by the brain, because the brain can exist dead or alive and not be conscious. Okay, somebody could be unconscious. They're alive but not conscious. So there's some tension there. Oh, there we go, another animation. I spent a lot of time doing these animations. Okay, I'm not moving on. Oh, there we go. And I think there are also difficulties with the claim that it's not just the brain, but it's the behavior of the brain. A lot of neuroscientists, including Hanel Seth, are looking at the behavior of the brain. It's the processes, the biochemical reactions and all that kind of stuff going on in the brain that actually gives rise to consciousness. And so what I would challenge about that is, so what is it about ions? If you know anything about the brain, you know that the brain works. Oh, so I've got a little video here. There we go, a little video. That's the synapse in the brain. And what you can see, those little dots are ions, electrically charged particles that are moving in and out of the synapse. The vesicles are coming down. Absolutely miraculous process. Anyway, but what is it about that, those ions moving in that way, that gives rise to consciousness, whereas ions flowing in a battery doesn't? Batteries, as far as I know, are not conscious. All right, so this, what is it about that? And how can the movements of neurotransmitters, which is what you saw in there, some of those dots were neurotransmitters that go across those synaptic junctions, how can that induce consciousness? Whereas the same biochemicals in a vat, for example, do not induce consciousness. Difficult questions for somebody to answer. And if it's true that consciousness really does exist in the behavior of neurons, why is it that my brain is conscious, but my gut is not conscious? All right, in my gut, I have 500 million neurons. I know it's a big belly, right? But 500 million neurons in here, but we do not associate consciousness with the gut. Some really challenging problems for that theory. And I think that conscious and brain processes are very different things, because we cannot measure them in the same way. So the measurements we apply to matter cannot be applied to consciousness. Right? So you can't take a ruler and measure your thoughts. You know, 6-centimeter thought this morning. Doesn't make any sense. You can't weigh how heavy your thoughts are or your conscious perceptions. So all those things suggest to me that there are very good reasons for being skeptical with regard to claims that consciousness is a property of matter or of how matter behaves. One more thing to throw in the mix that really is a tough one. I think it's a tough one. Actually, I had a conversation with Hanel Seth on Premier Conversations, I think it is. We did one of those episodes, and I didn't get round to asking him this one. And maybe next time I meet him, I will. But there's a growing body of evidence of people being consciously aware of what's happening around them when there is no detectable brain activity in them. So I don't know if you're aware of the near-death studies, been around for a while, that looks at phenomena like this, and there's a huge number of cases now where people report conscious phenomena, conscious experiences, when they cannot possibly have been conscious. So to get into this journal, the subjects in the papers have to demonstrate 3 signs of death. No dilation of pupils, no heartbeat, and no detectable brain activity. And yet, there are many, many reports of people being able to remember conversations that the surgeons had while they were dead, effectively. I'm not saying that that proves anything, except that it challenges the assumption that brain activity is the source of consciousness. Yeah, and I think it should cause us to question that. Right, I'm trying to land now. I'm coming into land. coming into land, and I introduce free will into the mix. Great. So I'm going to skim over this a lot. There's a lot you can say about free will, and I give a whole talk on that, and I could do that another time if I'm ever invited back. But free will is an important part of creativity, in my view. It's not just the decision to make a piece of artwork. So my wife is an artist, and she, Thursday was yesterday, wasn't it? Is her art day, created a picture of two hands coming together like that, like pulling somebody out of the weeds, which is beautiful. She decided to do that. It wasn't a random thing. She didn't roll a dice. She decided to do it. It was her free will. And the primary function of the free will, three things it does. It gives rise to original thoughts and new ideas. It can choose what the mind focuses on, really important for discipleship, by the way. And it initiates the execution of what is currently in the attention of the mind. My wife thought about this and then executed it. She created that piece of artwork. So let me kind of wrap up with some... This is fairly random and a little bit rushed put together. I wanted to try and pull it together somehow for you. And here are some areas of creativity that I think are worth thinking about: experience and skill, intentionality, representation, autonomy, and originality. And I just thought I'd draw together some separate thoughts on what human creativity is as opposed to generative AI. In terms of experience and skill, a human person... Consciousness is so important in the development of skill and in living experiences. Artists often express their lived experience through their artwork or through the things that they create. Learning is important. Inspiration, practice, learning from mentors, discovery of new ways of creating things. In terms of generative AI, the experience is the data. And it's just, effectively, you've seen it already. It's numbers. It's big, long lists of numbers, quite different to the human understanding, right? There is what we call learning. We call it learning, and I'm kind of reasonably happy of calling it learning as long as we don't humanize that a bit too much. It's finding statistical properties of data, effectively what it is, just by going through and applying an algorithm to do that. Some algorithms do exploration in their learning. That's true. They choose between random decisions or decisions that they think they've had experience before. And so there's some of that. Intentionality for a human being, that's all about their motivation, why they're doing it, their desire, they're wanting to communicate something to somebody else. In terms of generative AI or AI in general, it's a lot blander than that, right? It's just basically goals, what we call goals in computer science or AI, is a state of the world. You know, a robot will have a goal to move this over there. So the goal is that this is here, and it will have a representation of that internally. That's its goal, XYZ coordinates of object A. Quite different to our goals, right? Especially in the creative context. Representation, in human terms, it's an expression. When we create something, it's an expression of something. It's about our emotion and the sort of the story. We've seen what it is in the AI context. It's vectors, tokens, sequences. Autonomy in humans, bounded free will. I know it's limited, but we still have a degree a very good degree of free will. Choices that we make, generative AI, entirely algorithmic, and what we would call deterministic, in other words, entirely predictable. Even the dice rolling, right? This surprised somebody I knew who used to work in the computing industry, thought computers could really generate random numbers. No, they can't generate real random numbers. They're pseudo-random numbers, right? They look random to us, which is all that matters, but as far as the algorithm in the computer is concerned, it's not random. So they can't even do that, right? And then originality, thinking outside the box. Humans are really good at doing something they never would have thought of before. Just, I'm gonna jump off a cliff and see what happens, right? I've never done it before, I'm just gonna do it. AI tends to operate according to the statistics of its distribution. So even though that poem that I showed you at the beginning and all those images that we looked at that were amazing, are each one of them is unique. Right? There's nothing like it in the world, nothing on the internet like it. This is how we know some of our students have used ChatGPT to write their essays, because if you search on the internet, there's nothing out there that matches it. It's entirely unique, but it's only unique in the context of the statistics of the distribution on the data. Right? It's not going to go over there, because it doesn't know anything about over there. Right? It just knows about its data. If it goes over there, it can get it badly wrong. Right? So AI is always constrained to the data on it that it's trained on. It can create new things, but they're always in that context, and they always fit with the data on which it was developed. So that is it. I just wanted to share a little bit about my book, Rise of the Moral Machine. It's trying to tackle the problem of how we put, how we simulate moral competence in machines. I'm choosing my words very carefully here, after all that I've just said. And it's divided into four sections. The first section just gives you an introduction as to why this is important, why this has become a field of scientific inquiry over the last 10 years or so. I give a brief introduction to AI. This is not a technical book, so I'm not assuming any technical understanding of AI or anything of the sort. Oh, and each of the sections starts with a short story. You can see it there. Section two is motivation. The moral machines are coming and getting robots to behave themselves. How are people doing it? What are they doing? What kind of are they doing to the algorithms to make them behave well? Part three is about moral agency, what it means for a human being to become moral. I draw on psychology and what psychology tells us about human moral development. And then I kind of tentatively propose what it might look like for a robot to develop virtue. It's very hand-wavy, but it gives you an idea. And Dallas Willard plays a part in that chapter. And then the final bit really is, what's the implications of this? What are we trying to wrestle with? Human and robot autonomy is a big one. We mean different things when we talk about machine autonomy than what we mean about human autonomy. Moral singularity. Anybody worried about machines becoming smarter than human beings? Okay. That chapter hopefully will help you put your mind at ease, right? Both from a biological and neuroscience point of view and from a theological point of view, if you have that persuasion. And the final chapter kind of pulls it all together with, I think, I compute, therefore I am, as a provocative title. So that's the book. Happy to take questions if we've got time. That went over a little bit. Thank you very much.